Central Jersey Talk Radio, Central Jersey 1450, WCTC with the Restaurant Guys. Call them now at 732-545-9282. 732-545-9282.
Hello, everybody, and good morning. You are listening to The Restaurant Guys. I'm Mark Pascal, and I'm here with Francis Schott. Together, we own Stage Left and Cafe Lombardi restaurants in New Brunswick, New Jersey. We're here to give you the inside track on food, wine, and the finer things in life. You can listen to us every day from 11 to noon. Reach us through restaurantguysradio.com or download our podcast on iTunes.
Morning, Mark.
Morning, Francis.
How are you this morning?
I'm doing well. How are you doing?
I'm doing well. I got one thing to say.
Oh, dear.
Bum bum ba dum bum ba dum ba dum ba dum bum 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 ba dum bum ba dum ba dum ba da.
We're gonna talk about White House food today.
Anyone want to guess who our guest is today? The president? No.
President Bush?
No. President Clinton? No. But who would the restaurant guys want to talk to? But the chef to both Presidents Bush and President Clinton. There's a book called White House Chef, written by a guy named Walter Scheib. He was the chef to the Clintons and in the first term of the current Bush administration. He'll be joining us in the second segment of the show to talk about cooking for two very different first families and also cooking for the United States of America. Pretty cool stuff. Can we talk a little more locally first, though?
We can. Well, I don't know. Can we?
In a legal dispute pitting New Jersey's dairy farmers against New Jersey's milk processors, the state appellate division overturned a regulation that would have forced processors to pay farmers more money for hormone-free milk, but upheld a separate surcharge. Okay. The Department of Agriculture did not adequately justify a premium. This is what it's saying. A three-judge panel ruled last week that the Department of Agriculture did not adequately justify a premium of 76 cents per hundredweight for milk that is free of the hormone RBST.
I don't understand this. I do know how the dairy world works, and it's very highly regulated.
So the prices are set by the government. It's not free market.
Mm-hmm.
But what's happening is that these dairy processors are selling organic milk at a premium.
For more money. So here's what happens. They're buying all their milk for the same price because it is a legally set number. Okay, whatever the number is that week, that month, whatever, it's a legally set number. Then they're putting them onto your shelves and charging you a different amount depending on
whether it's organic or not.
Whether it's organic or hormone-free or not.
Now, why do they want 76, why do the milk producers want 76 cents more? Well, this is interesting. Here's where they get the 76 cent number. The 76 cent, this is all reported in the Star Ledger, which is a New Jersey paper. The 76 cent figure came from a pamphlet cited by a farmer at one of the public hearings. Well, who wrote the pamphlet? Who else but Monsanto, the maker of the hormone called Posilac, which has become the largest selling dairy pharmaceutical product in the country since it was introduced in 1994. Now remember, this is not traditional people. The traditional milk producers are organic. The new fangled producers are what's called conventional producers now, which means put a lot of drugs in your cows so your kids can have milk from drugged up cows. Okay. The pamphlet put out by Monsanto said that it would cost the farmer 76 cents more per hundredweight of milk if the use of RBST was stopped. Now, hold on. Let me explain this to you. Monsanto put out – now, the milk processors – are not going to pay farmers one penny more for organic milk than non-organic milk without the hormone. The farmers are saying, it costs us more.
It costs us more to produce this milk, and we are getting more and more and more demand from it, thank goodness.
And you, the processors, are making more. Sometimes, how much more a gallon, Mark?
Double. In most cases, it's double.
So the processors, and the retailers at least, are getting double the money for organic milk, but we don't want any of that money to go to the farmers. No, that's not possible. We want it to stop at the processor level. And you may wonder where the farmers got this 76 cents a hundredweight. The reason why Monsanto would give them that number, Monsanto issued that pamphlet saying, if you use RBST, it's 76 cents a hundredweight cheaper, in a separate issue because there are people trying to ban the use of this hormone overall. So what Monsanto issued that publication is an attempt to say we have to help our poor farmers.
Right. It'll cost dairy farmers 76 cents more to produce this milk than it costs them now.
So
Monsanto's the person who gave you this number. This number's not arbitrary. Monsanto says it costs this much more to produce organic milk. Thank you so much for that data.
So the dairy farmers are like, wait a second. On the one hand, you tell us that RBST we shouldn't make it illegal because it will cost dairy farmers 76 cents more a hundredweight. And on the other hand, you're saying, but if we don't use RBST and you know it costs us more than 76 cents a hundredweight, you're not going to pay us any more money, even though you're charging double for the milk. It's screwing the family farmer again.
For no reason, just for profit-taking.
And here's a toady. He's the New York State Dairy Foods Executive Vice President, Bruce Krupke.
We haven't given out a toady in probably in months.
Toady Award goes out today. This guy says, he's talking about farmers. Now, farmers are saying, listen, if we don't use RBST, then you can label the milk organic and get more money from it. So you should pay us more money because it costs us more money. Sounds like free enterprise, right? So what this guy from the New York State Dairy Foods says, the executive vice president, Bruce Kopke, he says in response to the farmers who say, listen, if we don't use RBST, you should pay us more because you get more. He says, why pay somebody for not doing something? What? We're still evaluating. I don't get it.
Oh, you totally get it.
Yeah, he's a greedy bastard who's using doublespeak to screw the family farmers. So
they pay somebody for not doing something. Very, very nice.
That's absolute nonsense. So what we're doing is the retailers are getting more, the processors are getting more, but by law the farmers can't get any rewards from their labor.
Awful.
And if it weren't for family farmers making choices to have organic milk, there would be no way for these other people to make
money. I have to go back for this for the people who haven't heard us talk about this before. Why do we care about the hormones in our milk? Why do we care? Okay. When we started adding these types of hormones to our milk, since that time, there's no data, there's no studies done.
There's no causal proof.
We know for a fact that the bodies of our children have changed. Okay, we know for a fact.
Now let's think about this. Now, okay, this is anecdotal. There's no clinical study that proves it. There's no way to test for hormone presence in the milk. But we know that pregnant women, shouldn't eat certain things because it's expressed in their milk, right?
Mm-hmm.
Yet we allow these. You wouldn't let your wife be on antibiotics, while she's breastfeeding your daughter. She didn't have to be, right?
Right.
But you're going to give your kid, the cow can be on antibiotics and feed your daughter. Wait a second.
It doesn't make sense. It just doesn't make sense. It doesn't add up.
And we're adding a growth hormone to milk that makes cows produce milk earlier and more, and changes the nature of their udders. Right. At the same time, we're seeing early onset of menses in our children, and there's no causal correlation been proved. But it's anecdotally, it's enough for me to say, you know what, I'll pay an extra 50 cents for my milk. Don't put hormones in my milk.
We know that it causes one of the problems from this hormone is it causes their udders to crack and bleed and pus, and they have to be on antibiotics constantly in order to...
And let me tell you something else about buying chocolate milk in the stores.
This we read on a website. We don't know 100% that this
is true. We're going to link you to a website that makes some accusations about why they take certain kinds of milk and make it chocolate that might not be as white.
Because the accusation is that the chocolate milk is...
It doesn't meet the white grade because...
You'll never buy chocolate milk from a store shelf again.
We'll put the link
ever.
Up on our website at restaurantguysradio.com. We'll be back in just a moment talking with the White House chef under two administrations, Walter Scheib. You're listening to The Restaurant Guys, Central Jersey, 1450. The time is 11:15. Hello, everybody, and welcome back. You're listening to The Restaurant Guys. Mark and Francis of Stage Left in Captain Lombardi Restaurants in downtown New Brunswick, New Jersey. Our guest today is Walter Scheib. He is a graduate of the Culinary Institute of America and was an accomplished American chef before he took the position of White House chef for President Mrs. Clinton in 1994. He held that position through the Clinton administration and even through the first term of the Bush administration.
Walter, welcome to the show.
Thank you much. Great to be here.
White House chef, that's pretty cool, man.
Well, I tell you, I got to do 3 times a day for 11 years, what most chefs never get to do once at all in their life, and that's to cook for the first family in the United States.
That's pretty amazing. Now, you have a book out called White House Chef by Walter Scheib that you wrote with a guy named Andrew Friedman. Yeah, why don't you tell us about the book?
Well, the book, first off, isn't really a cookbook per se. It's a book about cooking. And Andrew Friedman and I sat down, and we wanted to come up with not the best recipes that we had used at the White House, but quite honestly, the best, you know, 40 or 50 stories. And from those stories have recipes come out of those. So when you actually read the book, you'll get a lot better feeling for the families as real people and get to see them in the dynamic of a family and in, obviously, in their public life, too. But the recipes that are in there actually come out of those stories. So if we talk about Mrs. Clinton having a garden up on the roof, a produce garden on the roof, we have a recipe that comes from that. If we talk about teaching Chelsea how to do vegetarian cooking, there's recipes from that. If we talk about a steak dinner, then there's recipes that come out of that. So that's kind of how it is built. It's really not intended to be a cookbook per se, although the recipes are very, very good and very well conceived. It really is more of a storybook than anything else.
Well, let's talk about being the White House chef, because that's really a unique position in American culinary circles, and obviously a very important and prominent one. But you sort of wear two toques as the White House chef. You're basically the first chef of the United States of America for state dinners and formal events, and then you're also the personal chef for the first family of the United States. We want to talk about the difference between those two roles?
Sure. You know, as you're put out very clearly, that it really isn't a hotel or a restaurant. The White House, first and foremost, is a private home. So our first goal was to be sure that the both first families had a little island of sanity in the crazy world that is their life. They could come home and have as much of a normal life as possible on the second and third floor of the residence. And so a great deal of what we would do was, you know, designed around their style, what they really wanted to see. That, you know, many, many chefs build their own repertoire, and they have a reason why people come to their restaurants. When you're working at the White House, really, it isn't about you. You check your ego and you check your politics at the door, and it's about living up to the expectations of the first family. Now, that's half of it. The professional side of it is being out and sort of bringing American contemporary cuisine to the White House and have it be represented in the great formal and state dinner. So you're absolutely right. This is sort of a two-sided coin. You'd be making, you know, a bowl of oatmeal or wonderful chocolate chip cookies 1 minute and doing a state dinner for 900 the next day.
It's got to be a tough transition. You know,
it has its moments.
You talked about checking your politics at the door. Is that something you had to be very careful about? I mean, obviously, being the chef for the Clintons and then being the chef for the Bushes, two very different administrations.
Well, clearly that. Again, and as I said, though, our real goal, all 90 people who work in the residence, from the ushers right down to the guys who sweep the floors, really isn't about us or what we think politically. It's about our desire to make the first family comfortable and have a wonderful home to come home to.
Well, and I think that the interesting thing that, you know, sometimes we lose sight of in America too often in politics today is that, you know, whether you hate Bill Clinton or hate George Bush or love Bill Clinton or love George Bush, there is a certain amount of, you know, the White House is our house, and the first family is our first family as a country. And there's a respect for the office, a respect for the White House, a respect for the position of White House chef. Did you find that it was very different that your role as chef to the first family with the Bushes and the Clintons? I mean, they also strike me as two socially very different kinds of people to cook for.
Well, you think so on the surface, but I will tell you, it really divided, the styles of cuisine really divided more along gender lines than they did along political lines, in that both first ladies were very eclectic and adventurous diners. They had a pretty refined palates, and they were always trying new and different things. And both presidents, you know, in many respects, I think they would have been just as happy if we opened up a burger joint down in the basement and they kind of dined on the concept if it was good, it was better with melted cheese on it. So,
you know,
really very much guys in that respect, and no pretenses there. So you'd kind of aim, you know, at who was in charge of the function. If the first lady was there, you knew you had to have one style of food. If they were away or they were out for the weekend and the presidents were there, you knew you broke out the steaks and the chili and the nachos and those sorts of things.
You know, it's funny. It strikes me that you just put a vision in my head of Bill Clinton and George Bush meeting in the basement of the White House for a beer. And you think they'd have a good time?
I suspect they probably would. You know, that really is kind of the neatest thing about having worked at the White House, is that you do get to know the families, not as the political caricatures that they're portrayed in the media, but really get to see them as human beings, get to see the dynamic of their family, how they react with each other, other members of the family, how they react with their extended family, how it is during holidays, how it is during bad times. So you really do get to see them as human beings, and I will tell you that they are substantially different in many respects than you might suspect from their public personas.
Well, how are they different?
Well, you know, for instance, Mrs. Clinton, who in many respects has sort of a, I guess, a cold public persona, at least that's how some people have conveyed it to me, very loving and caring woman. We see her with Chelsea and her extended family, very, very personable. And the same thing goes with President Bush. You know, you see him sometimes has a difficulty in front of the microphone and by his own admission mangles the language. But when he's around his friends and family up on the in the private residence, very gregarious, very glib, very, very at ease with folks. So you know, I think really our goal, as I keep saying, was to give them a place to be just normal and just folks. And by their way they conducted themselves in the private residence, I think we succeeded because they were substantially different than they were out in public.
Our guest is Walter Scheib. His book is White House Chef, 11 Years, Two Presidents in One Kitchen. He was the White House Chef under both the Clintons and the Bushes, and we'll be talking more with him in just a moment. You're listening to The Restaurant Guys, Central Jersey, 1450. The time is 1125.
Let me talk to you about lighting, and specifically about how you can enhance the appeal of any space. Lighting is a powerful, emotional, and aesthetic force. It's one of the most important elements of design. More than anything else, it sets the mood and tone for an entire experience. A room pops or it doesn't based on lighting. Lights on 9 is a top-notch commercial and retail lighting supplier. Lights on 9 supplied all the lights for our award-winning Catherine Lombardi restaurant, inside and out, dining room and kitchen. Lights on 9 has everything from tasteful and stylish chandeliers to table and floor lamps, to outdoor lighting for illuminating a building or walkway or a sign. At Lights on 9, the service is exemplary, expert, and knowledgeable. They ship anywhere in the continental United States for free. Their retail store is in the Galleria Shopping Center on Route 9 in Manalapan. They're open 7 days a week. Call them at 732-308-9166. That's 732-308-9166. Or visit them at lightson9.com. That's lightson9.com.
Hello, everybody, and welcome back. You're listening to The Restaurant Guys, Mark and Francis, of Stage Left and Catherine Lombardi Restaurants in New Brunswick, New Jersey. Our guest today is Walter Scheib, who was the White House chef under the Clinton administration, as well as the first term of the Bush administration.
You know, Walter, as I've one of my favorite shows forever was a show called West Wing. And one of my favorite scenes in the show of all time, President Bartlet comes downstairs, and he's having a conversation with somebody, and somebody says, you know, is the job hard? He said, actually, this is the hardest part of the job. They're like, what do you mean? The hardest part of the job is knowing all this ice cream is down here all the time. And you know, in your book, you go into a little bit about, you know, when President Clinton was on his diet and some of the trials and tribulations therein of, you know, kind of their public eating habits. Is that something you had to confront a lot, you know, their dietary constraints?
Oh, clearly. You're feeding them basically, you know, probably 70 to 80% of their meals. You really have to worry about their nutrition and their caloric intake. Both first ladies asked that all the family menus that we would submit to them, and we would turn them in about a week in advance, would reflect the caloric intake, the grams of fat, basically all the nutritional breakdown. The tendency is, you know, when they're out on the road and traveling, that everywhere they go, whatever chef is cooking for them will put on their, you know, the grandest and greatest.
All the foie gras and caviar you
exactly.
can find.
Exactly. So when they come home, you know, to try not to make it Sunday dinner 7 days a week was a challenge, because obviously we took great pride in our job, but at the same time you had to know that some days, you know, a bowl of soup and a salad was going to work, you know, and that's what it took, and that's we really first and foremost wanted to be sure that the food product was safe, that their diet was conducted correctly, and then last but not least to be sure that they enjoyed the food they had.
Yeah, so nutritional food all the time that's really good for me and low in calories. Could you talk to my chef for me?
He's not cooking for your family, Mark. He's cooking for our patrons.
Because he feeds me about 80% of my meals, and I have kind of a similar situation.
You need to hire a private chef if you want that.
What you're saying is exactly right, because most chefs, they really want to put their best foot forward, and they perceive their best to be their most ornate or most, you know, caloric or grandest cuisine. But when you're doing it day in, day out in a private setting, you really have to cut back on that. Now,
and
on the other side, if you're doing steak dinners, you're really put on the dog.
Well, I want to talk, you know, it's funny because we in the restaurant, people don't come out to Stage Left Restaurant for the bowl of soup and a salad. That's not, we're not their home. They come out for the grand thing. But that's what I think is so interesting, Walter, about wearing two hats. And you're the most important private chef in the country, and you're one of the most important public chefs in the country. I want to talk about steak dinners and things like that when we come back, because a lot of people don't realize even what a steak dinner is or how formalized and how important these things are. We'll be talking about that with Walter Scheib. After the news, the book is The White House Chef. You can find out about it on our website, restaurantguysradio.com. Central Jersey, 1450. The time is 1130.
Central Jersey Talk Radio, Central Jersey 1450, WCTC with the Restaurant Guys. Call them now at 732-545-9282. 732-545-9282.
Hello, everybody, and welcome back. You are listening to The Restaurant Guys. I'm Mark Pascal, and I'm here with Francis Schott. Together, we own Stage Left and Capital Lombardi restaurants in New Brunswick, New Jersey. We're here to give you the inside track on food, wine, and the finer things in life. You can listen to us every day from 11 to noon. Reach us through restaurantguysradio.com or download our podcasts on iTunes.
Our guest today is Walter Scheib. Walter is author of the book White House Chef, 11 Years, Two Presidents, and One Kitchen. He was indeed the chef of the White House under both Bill Clinton and George Bush. And he joins us today to talk about his experiences therein and his new book. Walter, we talked before the news about how being the White House chef, you wear two toques. You're the family chef for the first family of the United States, and you're also the chef for the head of state of the United States. And when I say state dinner, just so you all know what a state dinner is given by the head of state of any country, and it is the most formal dinner that exists. And if you read a book, one of my favorite books on manners is a book, I think it's called Manners, The Rites and Rituals of Dinner, by a very intelligent woman named Margaret Visser. And she talks about highly ritualized forms of dining. She says the two most highly ritualized forms of dining are, she starts the book with a view of cannibals from the conquistadors were watching some of their compatriots be, you know, have their hearts ripped out and be eaten on the temple steps. And she takes the book, it starts with that and it ends with a formal state dinner. Are there any similarities between cannibalism and a state dinner, Walter?
Well, you know, I think some people's hearts may be figuratively ripped out, but I don't think I ever saw it in actuality.
No, there's no sacrifice.
That must be a heck of a book.
Humans, it's an amazing book. I'll put the link up on our website. But the human sacrifice aside, Walter, what is so? Can you tell us some of the intricacies of a state dinner and some of the formalities of a state dinner and what goes on in the back of the house and the front of the house? Because this is the most formal dining that exists.
Yeah, well, you know, just as you were saying, that it really is as high dining as exists, at least in the United States. You know, some other folks may say that they've got things going on in their country, but what it really is, it is the culmination typically of several days of meetings between two heads of state, the president and whomever. And it really is sort of the last thing after all the treaties have been signed and all the handshakes have been done that they get together and have a great dinner. And the dinner really is several parts. It's a reception beforehand where everybody gets to mix and mingle. It's the actual dinner itself. There's typically a very, very top A-list entertainment that takes place and then dancing and then the evening breaks up. The entire evening really lasts about, you know, somewhere between 5.5 and 6 hours. The dinner part of it is about an hour and 20 minutes, hour and 30 minutes. And the way it usually works is we would get something from the State Department's Office of Protocol saying that on such and such date and such country is coming, and here's some dietary restrictions that the principal has, and either for health-wise or personal-wise or through religious.
Yeah, if a foreign head of state dies from eating nuts that he's allergic to, you could really spark an international incident.
You joke, but it really is a big concern. You want to make sure that everything obviously goes out. And we always try to do a culinary tip of the hat to the guest country, whether it was some cooking technique, a flavor combination, or an ingredient that might be indigenous to their country. It's also part of American cuisine typically. So we do one course that would sort of honor the guest country, and the other courses typically would be very seasonal, very intrinsically contemporary American. And this would be planned, you know, a month or so in advance, depending on the timetable. We'd submit menus to the social secretary, to the first lady. They'd send them back. We'd actually do a tasting in many cases and refine the dishes. So in many cases, it's a lot more like a Broadway play than an actual sit-down dinner in that you've had a long time to really rehearse it, get all the kinks knocked out of it. So by the time you actually serve it, you know, hopefully everything goes perfectly because, you know, as I said before, it's not a hotel or a restaurant. We can't just comp dessert and give them 10% off the bill and hope it's even.
You know, we'll throw in an extra F-16 fighter. Sorry about your dessert running long.
But there are sometimes you're entertaining people from other countries, you know, several times a week. I mean, you talk about rehearsing these kinds of things, but, you know, you've got to be ready. You know, if the president's entertaining somebody tonight and somebody else tomorrow night, you got to be ready.
You're never able to say no. We had a full-time staff of about 6 top-level chefs, and we had an on-call list of about another 20 or 25 top-level chefs from Washington environs. And it really, you know, that was what we prided ourselves on, that we'd never said no, that we, just like any other restaurant, you never say no, you're extremely flexible, and whatever the guest wants is what you do.
But you can't flag the president, I guess.
No, not right. Too much.
He's got a driver, though.
That's
it's not
it,
that
you're
big
cut off, Mr. President. You're done. Well,
you
know, let me...
There's a funny story about that, if I might, very quickly.
Oh, please, you know, please.
Boris Yeltsin came to a state dinner, and as we all know, Mr. Yeltsin enjoys his vodka, and about halfway through the dinner, it became apparent Mr. Yeltsin was enjoying too much vodka. And the butlers actually took it upon themselves to basically empty out the wine bottles, fill it up with water, and pour him water for the rest of the evening to try to calm him down a little bit.
Wow. So you flagged Yeltsin. We flagged Yeltsin.
You know, when I wrote the book, I tried to get some people to own up to that story. Nobody would own up to it, but I know I was there. I heard it. I heard it the day it happened.
Ladies and gentlemen, we flagged another country. That's amazing.
We've been flagging other countries for a long time.
Yeah,
I think we refer to it as manifest destiny.
Yeah.
And, there we go.
You know. One of the things, I want to go back to the state dinner thing because I'm fascinated by it, and I've read about state dinners in the past. Is it really, and you know, you talk about a whole bunch of different people that you run this by. I mean, this is like not, I liken it to a wedding of mammoth proportions where it's, you know, it's all these different people that have to approve everything. What's it like for the social staff and you know, they have people who are in charge of protocol and making sure nobody makes a faux pas and who sits next to whom and which fork to use? Is it that formal?
Yeah, it really is. What you said, what the seating chart may be the most difficult part of the entire thing, and the social secretaries call that the grid, to be sure that everybody's sitting near somebody that they like, or more importantly, not next to somebody they don't like, and, you know, not just necessarily at the same table, but back to back at another table. So there's a whole bunch of juggling that goes on there. But in terms of who has to be happy about it, I kind of liken it that if there's 600 people at a state dinner, and the first lady's happy, and the other 600 hate it, then it's a success.
Yeah.
If 600 like it, the first lady doesn't like it, it's a failure.
I you know, that must be a tremendous constraint. Did you find that, and I think it's interesting, you know, we in America, I think most of us aren't used to having staffs in our home, you know, and it's... It's a very interesting situation you had, and you became close for a time, you became intimate with two first families. Do you think there's a personal relationship there that continues on, or that, you know, you think, you know, Chelsea will remember you when she's an old lady, you know, teaching her how to cook before she went off to college?
Well, I would hope that somewhere, you know, they got a million and one memories. I would hope somewhere it would stick. I do know that I'll remember it, I can tell you that much. I think we'll also... Being in the executive residence, fancy name for the White House, is a life-changing experience for the occupants as well as the staff. And I think you'd be hard-pressed to forget a whole lot, especially, you know, if we're working together for four straight years or for seven straight years, as may be.
Is it true that President Bush called you Cookie?
Not every day, but on occasion. The president loves his nicknames, and, you know, obviously he had called, when he was there as the son of the previous Bush president, he used to call that Chef Cookie, and he used to call me Cookie on occasion, but more often than not, hey, Walt, or, you know, just like that.
Well, let me ask you a question. Before you left his employ, did he ever come down and say, you're doing a great job, Cookie? You never said that?
Well, actually, not in so many words, but I do know that we sent out, in the first couple of weeks of the administration, we sent out enchilada dinner to him because they love their Tex-Mex, and he sent word back to the butler, tell the Mexican guy back in the kitchen it was great. I'll take that.
We'll be back in just a moment. We're talking with Walter Scheib. He was the White House chef under both Bill Clinton and George Bush. His book is called White House Chef, 11 Years, Two Presidents, One Kitchen. You can find out more about it at our website, restaurantguysradio.com. We'll be talking more with him in just a moment. You're listening to the Restaurant Guys, Central Jersey, 1450. The time is 11:44.
The place, Brooklyn, New York, post-World War II. An Italian-American woman named Captain Lombardi cooks for her family. What's so special about that? Well, lots. Food was central back then. Good food handed down from the traditions of two countries. Food that filled the whole house with the sweet smells of garlic, tomato, and basil. No matter when you stopped by or who you were sure to be fed and fussed over. Catherine showed her love on the plate and out of the pot. Any who were lucky enough to receive it never forgot. This is Mark Pascal from the Restaurant Guys Radio Show and Stage Left. I've just opened Catherine Lombardi Restaurant in New Brunswick, and its mission? To live up to the standards set by Catherine Lombardi. So come by the bar, sit by the fire. Have some fresh mozzarella and antipasto. The matagat and tortelloni are amazing, and the veal chop will make you cry. Our wine list, of course, without parallel. We've got to live up to the standards set by Catherine Lombardi. You see, Catherine Lombardi was my grandmother. Come let me show you where I came from.
Catherine Lombardi Restaurant in New Brunswick, 732-296-9463 or catherinelombardi.com. Hello, everybody. Welcome back. You're listening to the Restaurant Guys. Mark and Francis of Stage Left and Cafe Lombardi Restaurants in New Brunswick, New Jersey. Our guest today is Walter Scheib. He was the White House chef under the Clinton administration and also the first term of the Bush administration, and his book is White House Chef. Now, Walter, I'm sort of fascinated. We've had some friends who've had the presidents visit their restaurants. We have the governors of a couple of different states have come into our restaurants, and the state police sort of sweep in the day before or the day of and sort of case the room and make sure everything's okay, and there's a guy with a thing in his ear talking into his thumb in the corner table looking like he's having a creme brulee but ready to pull the machine gun out of his briefcase at any moment. What's it like food security-wise with the handling the first family's food? I mean, we've had someone, we've had heads of state in Europe have been poisoned in the last 2 years.
Well, clearly that's a big, big concern, and I can't get too deeply into detail with specifics.
Oh, yeah, you know what? I guess I should have figured that out.
suffice it to say, it really is an every waking moment concern of not only the Secret Service, but just as much the folks in the kitchen. Who would want to be identified and have their family identified for perpetuity as the John Wilkes Booth of the current generation? Clearly not that. And obviously, we tasted everything before it went up. We would like also not to keel over from some sort of adulteration of the food.
Mm-hmm. I think that must be fascinating because now was it your focus? I mean, the move, thank heaven, and one of the things this show is all about is trying to get people to eat locally, trying to buy from local farmers, from family farmers, from small producers. I would imagine that food security is harder dealing with a number of small farmers and the like. Actually, not.
It's just the opposite.
Well, tell us.
You'll find that the all secure purchasing is anonymity and infrequency. So you go a lot of different places. You go places that no one else knows about, and you don't go back there very often, and nobody knows who you are when you go in, when you go out. So your purchases, somebody would have to be doing a very, very broad-based attack on an entire area, and they wouldn't know necessarily to go. You would shop in a variety of different places. Any of the larger functions would come through very, very secure lines that the Secret Service had checked out from top to bottom. But
a lot of
the personal dining for the family was done simply by going out and buying stuff.
And I'd imagine that, like, a lot of the first family's food was tasted before they got it.
Yeah, well, as I said, all the guys in the white jackets, that's us in the kitchen, we managed to survive for all those years, not by taking in stuff that we weren't happy with and cooking it and eating it. We'd like to make it to the next week also.
Well, and also like to make it to the next week as far as keeping your job.
Yeah,
so yeah, it's clearly that, you know.
You rode in the presidential motorcade?
I did. That was coming back from I guess the Waldorf in Midtown Manhattan down to the landing zone. Most unique thing, I guess we were going down the FDR highway and up the elevated highway at 5:30 at night, no traffic going either direction on the highway, and you could look down below to see the avenues, out to the left, I guess out to the right side going south. And the traffic was back 3 or 4 blocks. I guess Manhattan must have just been completely locked down. And you look in the air, there's helicopters overhead, and out in the river there's a gunboat, speeding along next to you, and look at the speedometer, and I say, you really can't tell how fast you're going because there's nobody around you. Going like 120 miles an hour. It's like,
yeah,
wow.
Why not?
this is as cool as it gets. And then you get to the landing zone, and, of course, the limousine pulls right up to the Marine One for the president. The rest of us have to scamper over and get into the big, I guess they're called, the twin rotors. And the thing takes off, and the back door is open, and you're looking straight down, and then it lands, and president, of course, is right next to the Air Force One, so he gets on. The rest of us have to run, 150 yards across the tarmac on the concept that if you're not on the plane when they close the doors, you're not getting on the plane.
Right.
So you better move it.
You're catching the 707 out of LaGuardia.
Yeah, exactly. You better move it.
Can I share with you one thing? Living in New York and New Jersey for most of my life, when the president goes from the Waldorf or the UN to the heliport landing pad and you're driving alone on the FDR Drive looking down at all those people,
yep,
every single one of them, regardless of party at that moment, is cursing your very existence.
and wants you to drive at 120 miles an hour.
Get on the road!
Because they
get
want you off that road.
That was the most amazing thing, is to get the most powerful, one of the most popular cities in the world basically shut so one guy can get from point A to point B. And I said, that's juice. That guy.
That's not, can I get a reservation on Saturday night at 8 o'clock?
Yeah,
that's juice.
Like, can I close down your town for a minute?
Yeah. Speaking of that, one of the things that was in your book that really, really surprised me was the state of the White House kitchen, that the equipment in the kitchen was not what you would expect it to be. I would expect the newest, the best, the top-line equipment and everything you would possibly ever want to be in that kitchen. And that wasn't necessarily the case when you got there, was it?
No, far from it, actually. It really hadn't had any need to have that. The state dinners weren't done that frequently in the previous administrations, and the scope of what they were doing was relatively modest. It was sort of a European/continental style, all done on platters for smaller numbers. Mrs. Clinton's mandate was to really expand not only the style of the cuisine, but the numbers we were able to do. State dinner went from 120 up to 900 people during their tenure. At any rate, we got there, and the hood system, you know, if you lit a match in the place, basically would smoke it out, and then the BTUs are all like, you know, basically slightly better than a home, you know, like 10,000 BTU burners. That doesn't mean anything to your listeners, I guess, but probably to you guys it does.
Right, of course.
It does.
But it means it takes a long time to cook something.
Yeah, exactly. And
means I bought a special oven for my home.
So we basically tore in all the equipment out, redid all the walls in stainless steel, new ventilation system, new ceiling, sealed it in with a glass sliding doors, and it was basically made it our own little sort of Porsche engine, if you will. A very small kitchen. It's only about 30 feet by 30 feet, but very, very high-powered. And again, as I said, we were able to do, you know, state dinner for 900 people, which is 2,700 courses, basically, out of a glorified home kitchen, if you will.
Yeah, but I think sometimes people don't realize that, too, when you start talking about some of these dinners. If it's four or five courses and you're preparing for 500 people, that's 2,500 plates.
Exactly.
That's amazing. Well, I think it's great, and I think it's great that you were able to be there, and I think that, you know, the first kitchen of the United States of America should be able to cook some great food, and I think that may reflect maybe the rising importance of chefs and cuisine and our awareness of cuisine and our family farms here in this country. What do you think?
I think you're absolutely right. I really think that the last thing you said, for the diners to get out and really shop for themselves in a more intelligent manner, go out and find the farmers' markets, use the small farmers, the small growers, reward them for their hard work and the fact that they're turning out great product.
Hey, Walter, we have to leave it there, but I want to thank you for coming on the show.
You've been
a tremendous guest.
Thank you very much, guys.
Thank you.
That's Walter Scheib. The book is The White House Chef, 11 Years, Two Presidents in One Kitchen. You can find out more about Walter Scheib at theamericanchef.com. A tremendous read, and it's been a lot of fun. We'll be back in just a moment. You're listening to The Restaurant Guys, Central Jersey, 1450. The time is 11:56. Hello, everybody. Welcome back. You're listening to The Restaurant Guys. Mark and Francis, stage left and Kath on the party. We were talking with Walter Scheib, who was the White House chef under Bill Clinton in the first Bush administration, the first term of the second Bush administration. You know, one of the most interesting things that he had to deal with is that he was both the personal chef for the first family, as well as, you know, being a chef at an institution, not quite a restaurant, but certainly an institution. I recall we had one guy who had been a chef who then had been a personal chef for a large family, who then came to work for us for a while as a chef in our kitchen, and it didn't work out. And it strikes me that some of the problems that, you know, and I give this guy a lot of credit because he is able to do both jobs and brings the requisite perspective and experience to both jobs. But what was interesting was this guy, who worked for us for a while, he could really cook. And I'm sure he was a great personal chef, but as the executive chef of a restaurant, he couldn't handle
that. It didn't work in the which is because they're different dynamics, I think, is really the issue, is they're very different dynamics. Not to mention the fact when you're cooking for a family, you know, sometimes the family wants a simple dinner. And sometimes they want to have, you know, the most elaborate dinner in the world. You know, the same guy who makes your chicken wings is the same guy who makes your foie gras. And that, I think, is, you know, very frequently two different guys in the real world.
And I think that for a personal chef, it's on demand of the family. You serve at the will of a family to cook this or that. Whereas cooking in a restaurant is, we come up with something that we're going to offer, and we try to entice, and we hope that it fills a niche and entices people in to our restaurant. But I think that there's more room for creativity. But there's also it's a different kind of discipline to be a chef in a restaurant, and I've always found that to be fascinating. And I never really had considered it before we had this guy who had worked as a personal chef for a long time, and some of the stuff that he just couldn't, we really didn't see eye to eye on, didn't work in a restaurant environment.
But I mean, you talk about Walter Scheib was our guest today, White House chef. You talk about the very different types of things he did. You know, if Chelsea's friends came over from school, you had to cook one way. You had to make pizza and you had to make, Chateaubriand. I mean, completely different ends of the spectrum.
Yeah. I think it's fascinating. It's great. The book is great because it's full of anecdotes and stories, and I would pick it up. White House Chef, you can find that on our website. I hope you've enjoyed the hour listening to The Restaurant Guys. I'm Francis Shai.
And I'm Mark Pascal.
We are The Restaurant Guys, Central Jersey, 1450. The time is 12 noon.